Hello and welcome to We're All Gonna Die and Other Fun Facts, a semi-regular, occasionally amusing, and rarely funny series of conversations on a random topic. This episode is entitled Make Your Own Damn Records, and it's about taking a love of music and turning it into a business. And our guest for this episode is someone who knows a little something about the music industry, Mr. Mike...
Siemens.
I psyched myself out on your name. It was like almost too easy. And Mike, what do you do for the kids at home who don't know, though they should?
I run a vinyl record store called Mind Cure Records. And along with that, I also run a record label of the same name, Mind Cure Records, which is the store is about 4 years old. It's located in Pittsburgh in the Polish Hill neighborhood. And on top of running the store, I do a vinyl record label, which is focused on Pittsburgh music, both new and old.
Awesome. So why not sell like cars or cemetery plots or things people actually need?
That is a question I ask myself frequently of why did I end up here, or, you know, how did I end up here? And the most that might be the hardest question, at least so far. I grew up really being into music and getting into records. I worked at a record store starting when I was in high school, which at that time was called Paul CDs, which is now called Soundcat Records. Great record store. And I had this moment that I thought, I should do this for myself, and I should open my own store. And so I did it, somehow. And, you know, that's the abridged version of what brings us up till now.
All right. So, I guess you got a sense of how the industry worked and stuff at Paul's.
Yeah.
And so you could say there was kind of a strategic plan or... You know what I mean? I guess that's the thing, because there's that weird dynamic, because you think, like, punk rock or any... I have this problem with a lot of my, like, creative friends or friends who are in the art. Like, they're not supposed to be practical. You know what I mean? They're not supposed to know what they're doing. It's supposed to be this, like, lovely, romantic, happy accident. But that's kind of not really how things work, right?
I mean, I still don't know that I know what I'm doing. I am increasingly believing that I don't know that anyone knows what they're doing. So that's not just, I don't think it's unique to me, and I'm learning to live with learning to live with that, you know, sense of, you know, just general confusion that seems the company's, you know, running a business in life. But yeah, I mean, working at a store and having a background, you know, in the day-to-day operations of what it takes to keep a store open, I would accredit to the fact that I still have a store.
Absolutely. I mean, 4 years at, you know, you think you're getting in the industry at a time when, I mean, it's sort of like the rats going back into the burning building, isn't it?
Yeah.
This moment in history.
Absolutely. The thing that, you know, I learned from, you know, from working at Paul's and was really like taking care of the people that keep you in business. Like, you know, that store 100% was kept in business by people who came in. You know, it's funny. There are people that were like, oh, this guy's an every Tuesday record shopper and he comes in on new release day. And then there were like the Saturday people. And then there were, you know, just the people that would consistently come back and knowing what it was that they were interested in. And being able to recommend stuff to them, or, you know, anticipating that they might want something. And that was the whole model for that business. And I, you know, took that and thought, okay, well, I could do that for, you know, this even more specific subset of people. You know, Paul's and is, you know, Soundcat still, but like... was built on this really classic record store model, which is having a really, you know, good selection of a wide variety of genres. You know, if you wanted jazz, there's an amazing jazz selection there. If you wanted, you know, blues, there was amazing blues selection. If you, and you know, it was like the indie store. It was like, you know, making sure that labels like Touch and Go, Drag City, Matador, like the indie majors or whatever people call them. Mm-hmm. But that it wasn't just that. It had something for, you know, everyone. For that's not true, but you know, like so what I do with my store is I've like broken that down even further and realized that there's a subset of people, particularly who are into like punk rock and heavy metal and, you know, noise and, you know, things that are not on the super commercial side of music, and trying to stock a store with records that they would really want.
That's funny that you should say that, because there is a little out of town, I won't say what store or the person, but there was somebody who, I guess, still sort of owns a record store in the region, mm-hmm. who said about your store, about Mind Cure, it's just like, I don't even get some of the stuff in there. And it was like really interesting, like, to hear that person who has a record store and saying that about your store. It's like, I don't understand it, you know? And that's kind of, I found that interesting, and I just kind of was like, yeah, you know? I mean, that was one of the things, I think, the first time I went to Mind Cure, I realized, like, oh, I've been around, I remember grunge, you know? Mm. Sort of like, you can get that sense of hubris about your own taste in music. And I just, every time I go there, it's like, there's stuff I need to learn, you know, which is so cool.
Well, and I couldn't even describe, if you asked me to describe what is represented in the store, I can't even really do that. Like, I can't, it's not like there is this, I mean, there's like a idea behind it, but there's not really like, I mean, there's punk stuff that comes out that like I'll totally miss, and people come in and say like, did you get whatever reissue or new release? And I'm like, that's totally new. I can't claim like I know everything, and I'm going to make sure that everything is there and that, you know, really, if you know, the store is a representation of like my own interest in music and the things that I'm into, and then just try, you know, having a sense of who it is that are my customers and trying to get stuff that I think that they would be into, or try to get the stuff that they want. You know, and there's sort of the contradiction in all that is the used section of the store, which is, you know, the used section, I mean, I get in stuff that's, you know, I mean, everything from, you know, classic rock, you know, jazz, soul, like, you name it. Like, if I, you know, it's not that I'm only trying to run a certain type of store, you know, but that's, it's, you know, whatever I find or whatever, you know, walks in the door, or whatever, you know, I come across when I'm out looking for records.
Yeah, which is weird too, because you think then you're almost like on the other end as like a fixer or a matchmaker. There's like a weird intimacy then with a customer base, because, you know, I remember like a couple times I would be, you know, have headphones on or something, I'd be bopping around and somebody asked, what are you listening to? And I'm prejudging them, but sort of like, oh, they're not going to get it. And I'm just like, oh, you know, some stuff. You know what I mean? And it was almost like it was too personal. This person asked me, well, what's in your ear right now? But in a way, your job is to sort of plunge the depths, almost like some sort of, like, you know, vinyl hawking, like, almost like the vinyl, you know, equivalent of, like, sex therapist or something. You know, it's like it's people's intimate lives, and you have to know what's going on there or something, you know?
I think the best, I mean, you know, again, this, it does relate a little bit more to used records than new stuff, but Jerry Weber of Jerry's Records had this really great kind of metaphor for being a record salesman, and then also in terms of being a record reseller, which is, it's sort of like being like the ferry boat captain, or like the person who like takes, you know, people from one place to another place, but you're like taking these records and you sort of see where you think they should go. And it's like your job to get them from where they were into this other place that they should be. And the, you know, so whether it's just you're looking through a bunch, you know, looking through a record collection, you're seeing different stuff, and, you know, and you're thinking, like, you know, can you sell it? But also, like, who is this going to go? Like, who is going to buy this? And, you know, at the risk, you know, you don't want to over, you know, put too much into that statement, but like, it's not like I would think anyone who sells records and think they have this sort of spiritual, you know, role in the world. It might be a little bit of a grand sense of self, but like, you know, that's really it. Is, you know, can you look at something and think like, I know who would buy this or someone would want this, and you know, get this from point A to point B.
Yeah, which is that's cool, because, and I think too, I mean, there's also this incredible like world music collection mm-hmm. in your store that has actually, I will say, turned me on to some things. I bought stuff just because, like, yeah, we're like, well, this is here, so it can't be that bad. You know what I mean? Like, and that's I think a real cool like kind of mark of quality. So which I guess what leads me to the next thing I wanted to talk about is. Since it is obviously you started as a music fan, mm-hmm. right? I mean, it's just you collect yourself, mm-hmm. and then you get this job, and then it becomes kind of, I guess, your life. Mm-hmm. Has that changed your relationship to your own maybe personal music consumption, or how you think about like your own music? Mm-hmm. Like, oh, that's business music, mm-hmm. and now this is.
Absolutely.
My thing, or
I mean, one of the major things to be kept in check is, am I keeping too much stuff for myself? Because like, it's you can't shake that.
Yeah, that would be. Yeah, that would be.
And that gets
problem.
Tough because you know, like, you'll get this really amazing record collection. And you're like, I want it all. I'm gonna keep it. You know, yeah. If you did that, then you go out of business. So
yeah.
It's like, I actually still try to make sure that I go and just go record shopping, where I'll like, Jerry's is, in my opinion, Jerry's Records is the greatest record store in the world. I love Jerry's.
Yeah, it's
Jerry,
a great place.
The person, everyone who works there, I consider them all friends.
Mm-hmm.
On days off, I will go and just like spend several hours just hanging out there and, you know, sitting around and like get pizza and whatever. And it's also just... like this very relaxing thing to me mm-hmm. to just go somewhere and you're not thinking about, you know, like reselling anything, and you're not thinking about anything other than just looking for some new stuff. And I also, you know, just find, you know, like I was there last week and I found all these records. I didn't really even know what some of them were, and then just like listening to them at the listening station and just sort of getting to enjoy that. And I think that's really important, to like still just want to go out and just, you know, do what you've always enjoyed doing. It's just like, it's, you know, I wish if I didn't work Saturdays, it'd be like, go spend Saturday at a record store.
Yeah.
But instead, it's usually a Monday or a Tuesday when I have the day off to go and hang out in a record store. And then in turn, but you know, that's like the major part. And it sometimes will get like stressful, divorcing the idea of like looking at something without the idea of could you resell it, or like reading about music without the idea of like I need to go and like get this and try to, you know, get that release and sell it, and instead just sort of remember that it's something that you really enjoy and that you're excited about and that you just want to continue to experience in the same way.
Yeah.
And you know, and talking to people who used to have stores and talking to people who have been in the record business for a really long time, that's an important balance for them, to not just sort of like just like lose your sort of like perspective on what it is that you enjoy about music or records.
Yeah, and I can confess that's something I asked that question knowing full well that that's something that I struggle with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm an English professor and I'm sort of... I've gone to almost taking the stance full on that books are for chumps. Like, you know what I mean? Like, there's no distance anymore. And, like, my interest is, like, sort of contemporary pop culture.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of like I can't go to movies without going, yes, yeah, mm-hmm. see, I could teach that in 40. Like, I want to see, like, something like Beast of Southern Wild or Blue Jasmine. And I remember both times leaving the theater thinking... well, in 40 years, if I'm still alive and teaching, I can do a special topics course on America at the beginning of the new millennium. And I would so show those movies. And just thinking, like, and realizing, like, wow, that's a problem that I have.
Yeah, although...
like, I mean, I'm broken.
But at the same time, like, that, you know, when you tell me that, I also hear, you know, that you're, like, engaged and excited about stuff. It's, like, changed what you're, the way you would have encountered a movie or some piece of pop culture, you know, however many years ago before you would have adopted that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you're still thinking, I don't know, like, it's not like you're like, I fucking hate movies now and I never want to go to the movies again. You know?
Yeah.
So at least it's like being engaged in some way. I think that's positive.
Yeah. You know, but then I also have an office on the third floor of this house full of books. And I just look at them like, yeah, novels.
Mm-hmm.
That's a thing. You know what I mean? And they're just like, no. I got to read papers anyway. But no, you know, which is sort of weird. It does. And I have another musician friend who said that, like, being a musician, being in a band,
mm-hmm.
like, spoiled music for him.
Yeah.
Which is, like, kind of sad.
But. One of my biggest mentors and role models and, you know, I mean, surrogate parental figures that I've had in my life would be Bill Boyshell, who has Copacetic Comics upstairs. I've known Bill since I was, if I had to guess, I would say 5.
Wow.
His original store, which was called BEM, which was more of just like a traditional comic book store. It was in Wilkinsburg.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up close to that store in Wilkinsburg, and so I started going there when I was really young. And Bill has shaped a lot of my, you know, tastes in consumable, commodified culture. Mm-hmm. And I could guess how old Bill is. I don't really know. I don't think very many people know how old Bill actually is. So I don't know. I couldn't say, like, at this point in life. But for someone who had, you know, started running a store previous to that, had had a whole career as a program director at Pittsburgh Filmmakers, and showing films, mm-hmm. and putting together film programs, you know, so he's, you know, well at a really conservative and, you know, well over 30 years and working with pop culture. His enthusiasm for all this stuff that he stocks and that he just has a love of all of it. And it's like this general pursuit of like this mastery and understanding of things that I take a lot from. Like, I don't know how to put it. It's not like I'm always thinking, like, well, what would Bill think? But, like, I really am inspired by that to see how he still loves books and the way that he talks about books. And then there's, you know, comics and just art and music and film and a connectivity that he sees through all of it. And it's just, you can tell that just it's like the pleasure that he derives from it is huge.
Yeah, and it's so interesting you should say that, too, because, I mean, we were just talking, and I was just saying my impression of your store first time I was there. The first time I went to Copacetic was when it was over in Squirrel Hill by the police station. You know, that tiny little storefront that I think is still vacant. But I just remember walking in there and just feeling like I had stepped into a new world.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember totally, and this is, again, the level of geekdom, I think, for me, for books. I remember telling people, they, like, have a whole display of Dover Thrift editions of all the classics. They got the Dover Thrift line, you know, like, there. And just totally tripping out on that. And then seeing, like, oh, somebody thought about it and cared enough to know, yes, Dover Thrift is what people need.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing is that in the store, you know, I mean, right now, like, you can go up there and he has what's, like, a New York, like the Goldfinch, like a New York Times best-selling novel. Yeah. But then also there's a whole table of stuff of things that are, you know, editions of 25 Xeroxed, you know, mini comics.
Yeah.
And he can talk about those things with this equal level of enthusiasm. And
that's really cool, yeah.
So it's, you know, again, like, I think similarly, a lot of people, I mean, the other thing about Bill's store is that this has probably changed, but for a long time, let me start over. There was a period of time where Bill's store was the only full-service bookstore in the city of Pittsburgh. Like, when Barnes & Noble and Squirrel Hill closed,
yeah,
there was no more just, like, bookstores in the city. There were used bookstores. Yeah. Caliban's, great used bookstore. Lots of great used bookstores.
Yes.
But that could get you a New York Times bestseller.
Mm-hmm.
Bill's store, Copacetic, was the only one. And so I would tell people, like, don't go to Amazon. Like, if you're looking for a book,
yeah,
look and see what it is on Amazon, email it to Bill, and he'll get it for you just as fast as you would get it from Amazon. And people would go up there, and they'd be like, I don't even get, what is that store? You know, and they're like, it's a comic book store. And I'm like, well, it's not really a comic book store. And they're like, well, I didn't really understand what it was, and I didn't, and so, again, it's like, and I think that that's the, you know, in the sort of grand scheme of things, I think that that is what is amazing about retail in 2014 mm-hmm. is that you don't have to have a store which makes sense to everybody.
Yeah.
But for the people that'll walk into a place like MindCure or to Copacetic, like the people that are really into it, you know, tend, in my experience, seem to connect with it pretty quickly. And they're like, oh, I get it. This is the place I've been looking to go.
Yeah.
And maybe you knew that you didn't know where that place was and you found it, or maybe you didn't even know you were looking for it. Yeah. But it's cool to see that happen in my own store and to see it happen in Bill's store. And I think that that's what makes, you know, brick and mortar businesses really interesting now. I mean, you can buy literally anything illegal or legal on the internet. So you don't have to leave your house. If you need a tea kettle, some socks and some batteries, you can go to Target. But like, you know, finding a place that's like this, you know, externalization of someone's, you know, cultural tastes is what I think makes stores interesting now.
Yeah, that's really well put. And that was always been my thing. You said it better than me. Because I've always told people, I was like, yeah, when the Barnes & Noble closed and when Borders disappeared, though I was talking to somebody yesterday. And they're like, Borders, God rest its soul, or whatever. You know, like they were eulogizing Borders. And I keep telling to people that it becomes this like sort of geek freak niche mm-hmm. sort of thing, and those are the people who are still, you know, it's part of my Miller Lite theory.
Okay.
My Miller Lite theory is that, you know, Miller Lite is the beer that does not taste like beer. Mm-hmm. It is beer for people who hate beer. Uh-huh. You can have a Miller Lite.
Uh-huh.
You know, and you can still think you're having beer. And I think that there is this whole economy that is built, and it's a sort of mainstream economy that is built on the Miller Lite principle.
Yeah.
And so there's a place to buy books for people who hate books.
I still kind of love chain bookstores, only because they're, like, incredibly strange. Like, if you really think about, like, going to, like, I guess now, if I'm at the waterfront, I'll go to the Barnes & Noble.
Yeah, it is a B&N, yeah.
And you'll go over there, and you just, like, you go to this section, and you're looking at it and you're like, who picked these books for this section? Like, there's something that's like really interesting, and then there's like a book you've never heard of before, and you're like, oh, I wonder what that book is in the psychology section. And then you're just looking at it as a whole and you're like, who picked, like, really, like, who's in charge of this decision to curate these specific items?
Books, yeah.
And then, you know, the whole section of like cheap books where like they're publishing their own like fake, like, you know, leather-bound looking volumes of Sherlock Holmes.
Yes.
And it's just like, it's like,
that's Miller Lite right there. Yeah. I worked for, my only retail experience was, I worked at a place called the Book Market.
Okay.
Which was, I don't think it exists anymore, but it was this business model where they would sign a 3-month lease on some empty, vacated big box store in a strip mall somewhere.
Okay.
And they would set up just plywood tables, and there would just be stacks of books, just mm-hmm. rows and rows of books. And if after 3 months they made a certain amount of money, then they keep the store open for another month or another month.
Mm-hmm.
And then once it dropped, they would box everything up and send it somewhere else.
Okay.
Was the model. And what it was all the rejects. It was all the stuff that had been returned to Barnes & Noble or returned from Barnes & Noble that they couldn't sell.
Mm-hmm.
And the company, I remember they were telling me they were bidding against people who wanted to buy these, like, containers full of books to pulp them for recycling.
Okay.
Or you could still have the book with the words in it, you know? It was the model.
And so they weren't, like, picking the titles.
There was no editorial control whatsoever. That was down to, and I was the guy with the English degree, was what, that's what I was hired for, because each store had, like, 6 employees. And that was it. And there was the guy, oh, he does English. Okay, you know books.
Yeah.
You'll know what the end caps are and mm-hmm. what to make prominent and stuff. But it was really fascinating because it was probably 100,000 titles.
Wow.
I mean, we were in the old, it's now an Office Max in Monroeville. It used to be the Kids R Us, clothing store.
Yeah, yeah.
We saw the changing rooms and stuff, you know. And so we had this huge, massive store, all these just plywood tables, with like held up by sawhorses, and just books.
Mm-hmm.
And it was when the Da Vinci Code was really popular.
Okay.
And people would come in to the store, and there would be this ocean of books. And if you just waded in, I mean, I remember, I think I spent more money at that store than I made.
Oh, yeah.
When I worked there. It was awful. And I was our primary source of income at the time because Danelle was student teaching. And people would come into that store that way. They would find somebody with the name tag, mm-hmm. march up to them and say, do you have the Da Vinci Code? And I would say, sorry, we don't.
Mm-hmm.
And they would, it was like they were standing on a lazy Susan. They would pirouette and just boom, right towards the door. And that was it. There was not any interest in any other type of reading.
I think the remainder books is a really great window into the current world of American. I mean, maybe it's international. I couldn't say, but of you know consumerism and advertising and just like realizing that people have no idea what they're selling. 'Cause,
yeah.
So I was just recently in New York. One of the things I always love doing in New York is going to the smaller and smaller number of remaindered bookstores, mm-hmm. you know, the Strand being the one that's, like, yeah. you know, the most known. And this, and normally I'd go in the Strand, and I would, like, I would just, like, lose, you know, I'd just buy so much stuff, and it'd be, like, amazing art books, you know, like, retail for $80 and get it for $15,
or, yeah.
then, you know, whatever, like, just so much stuff. And especially if your tastes are off the beaten path. Mm-hmm. You'll find all of these things that like a major publisher took a chance on.
Yeah.
They couldn't sell and now they're like liquidated.
Yeah.
But you know, what's I'm totally sidetracking myself. Mm-hmm. What was really interesting about this is that this time I went to the Strand and I was looking at this stuff and it like wasn't that much cool stuff.
You know, I went through that with remember the cutout CD bin or cassette bin era where that's what it was. It was the thing where like the MTV Buzz Clip didn't take off.
Yeah.
And as a 90s kid, they were still really good records.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
To buy. And I have a whole attic also full of those things that I have to pack and whatever. But there was a period, right, where it was just sort of, it was over.
Yeah. And so I think that, you know, part of it is that now that those bookstores, you know, their physical proximity to the world of publishing in New York City gave them this advantage into mm-hmm. buying that stuff for one time. So if you wanted to find that stuff, like, where else are you going to get it?
Yeah.
Now, you know, Kovacetic, Bill gets, he, like, combs through these lists of remaindered stuff and gets the best stuff, you know. So I was like, all right, half the stuff I saw the Strand I knew I could get in Pittsburgh. But then the other thing is now places like Half Price Books, they're, like, some of the last standing bookstores. So what they're getting, like, this obscene amount of volume from publishers that are just, like, dumping stuff on them more and more and more. And what was my original point? My original point was that I think remaindered books really show that now people don't really know how to sell things. Like, you know, publishers are publishing books and thinking, like, you know, is this new self-help book about becoming gluten-free or whatever, like, on its own merit, is it just going to sell itself? But you don't see, like, you know, books coming out and people really, like, putting the effort into selling them and, like, promoting them and letting you know this is amazing and this is... It's just, like, there's this whole scattershot, you know, method to, you know, books, records, whatever. People are just putting out whatever they can and hoping that some of it takes off.
I know, and that was the thing about the Da Vinci Code. Was the miracle of the Da Vinci Code was how it was sold. That was like the last book that was like, we will just pump this out. And like the Barnes & Noble owns Viking. It was this idea like, listen, we're going to send as many copies out for reviews as we would if we had Stephen King.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were going to get all these reviews. We're going to push it. And it was this guy. I mean, Dan Brown did not have a particularly good contract.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're like, we can manufacture this hit. And I think I because I wrote about it in a scholarly way. But I found that between 2003 and 2006, that book outsold the entire Stephen King franchise during the 90s.
Wow.
They sold that many copies of that book as Stephen King sold, all Stephen King sold in the 90s.
Wow.
And the big gamble was then the book that was the follow-up. That was supposed to be the book that was supposed to save bookstores and publishing. Wow. And people were like, oh.
You want to know what's really interesting to me, and I don't know if you ever look at this, but I love looking at the every week. I only read a newspaper once a week now. Mm-hmm. I think that there's just like too much news in the world, so I read the newspaper on Sundays.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably one of my most expensive habits, getting the New York Times on Sundays.
Yeah.
But I love reading the bestseller lists.
Yeah.
And I think it's a really interesting window into the world of, you know, America.
Mm-hmm.
And what I realized is that, you know, it seems that right-wing people read more or buy more books. Yeah. Because you'll see books that are like, you know, like, especially on the nonfiction side, mm-hmm. it's all the stuff like Bill O'Reilly's book.
Yeah.
You know, a book about the little boy who like died for a minute and
Heaven
Jesus
is real,
or whatever.
Yeah.
And you look and you're like, this book has been a bestseller for like 78 weeks.
Yeah.
And what was wild with the Bill O'Reilly has a book called Killing Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And what was amazing is that came out like within 2 weeks of this really well written scholarly research book about the life of Jesus that was
that guy who got in,
Fox News. Did you see
the Fox News weird interview? Yeah.
Yeah, which was so amazing of this woman who, I don't even remember who the woman interviewing was so sure he had this like crooked agenda about the life of Jesus, and you know, he's a religious scholar and you know, PhD, whatever. And I thought it was amazing that his book fell off the bestseller list, and Bill O'Reilly's book, Killing Jesus, is still on there.
Yeah.
And I don't know why, you know, what it is, whether it's like right-wing, you know, people want to like make sure they're supporting Bill O'Reilly.
Thing, yeah.
I don't know if that number is skewed because if you went to Costco, you'd see like 1,000 copies of it that they're buying at retail just to like support the I don't know, but...
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's the Miller Lite thing, or is it that maybe they're just more focused? You know, because you think about it too, like you look at Middle America, and I think about it, because I went to St. Francis that's... in the middle of nowhere, Pennsylvania. And I still hang out with friends from up there. And, like, you know, George's, if you've ever been to George's Song Shop in Johnstown, is an amazing store, but it's the one.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it.
Yeah.
And, like, all the stuff that they can't get or they don't have access to, like, they don't even get to see Oscar movies.
Oh, yeah.
Sometimes it doesn't play on the multiplex up there. And so it's like, I know that I live in this like completely different cultural world than them, though I can get there in an hour and a half.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a matter of what can they get.
Yeah.
And so it's like, what's at Walmart? You know, what's the three books that they have?
Yeah.
Is kind of weird.
Which is apparently the 50 Shades of Grey trilogy.
Yeah, which is, with that fulfills a need and all that other stuff. So you're doing a couple other things though. You are also putting out records.
Yes.
Too.
I started putting out records about 10 years ago, and I did a label with some friends of mine they had been sort of doing it for a little while. It was called TBA Records, and I came on, and they had done some CD releases, and I came on, and we did this, like, the first vinyl release on that label, and then eventually I wanted to go off and do a label on my own and focus more on Pittsburgh punk and heavy metal stuff, and that was called Deer Skull Records. And I ran that up until I started the store. And, I mean, it overlapped, but, like, I had all the projects that I had with the store had sort of started before it opened. And, you know, one point I just thought, well, I should just like stop because I don't have the attention to do it. It was getting harder, you know, like for one time that was like I sold records on eBay, you know, in between leaving the other record store and opening my store. Like, I sold records on the internet, I ran that record label, and that was my life. So, like, it was harder for me to focus on it. And then also, it, you know, when you open a business and you realize like something that doesn't really 100% have to do with like what you do to run a store, you should probably like drop it. And what I ultimately did was compromise and merge them. Mind Cure Records was originally a record label, and so I decided, which I, you know, had taken the name for the store, and I decided to restart the label and originally just do, I just wanted to do reissues of Pittsburgh, you know, punk and heavy metal, hardcore. And there were some people, mainly, I mean, actually, surprisingly, people who would, I would say, were like my peers, who would have been more in the bands that I was working with, they were like, oh yeah, that makes sense. But it was like people who were older than me that would be more contemporary of the stuff that I was reissuing were saying, like, you shouldn't stop doing new bands. Like, don't,
you know, wow.
You need to keep doing new stuff. So that's where I came up with this idea of the single of the month, was to sort of have this really contained project, contained only in scope, not in energy. to sort of do that and not get into, like, you know, recording albums, to not get into, like, well, what's the artwork going to be? And so that's how the Mind Cure Records, the label, came back. You know, I think the last release on Mind Cure Records came out in 1994, and then, you know, sort of was dormant until the store started, and then 2013 was the year that the label came back with a release. So the singles project, which is, you know, like a 2-song 45 with an original on the A side and a cover song on the B side, that's going to come to an end in June, which will be the official 4th anniversary of the store.
Wow.
And I'm not going to do it for another year. I decided it's going to be a 1-year project, and I'm working on a different project, which it still needs to sort of come together, but to do something that would be, like, in the same spirit of promoting new bands and sort of focus. Because the other thing is, I love to show what's going on in Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
Pittsburgh is going through renaissance. I don't know what the right word is. People are actually moving here. You know, growing up here, your tends to be your experiences, all of your friends leave because, you know, like, there's no jobs, and their dad got a new job, or their mom got a new job, or, you know, whatever. To really, from, you know, music in Pittsburgh has, you know, I feel like been sort of very underrepresented in what's been going on nationally. There have been some bands that got, you know, pretty big, but in general, as like a music scene, it wasn't a city that's, it hasn't been a city that's been really renowned, even though I think there's lots of cool stuff going on here, and I wanted to show, like, there's all these bands in Pittsburgh and doing 12 records in a year of, you know, varying sort of subgenres under the umbrella of rock music, to sort of show, like, look at how much stuff is going on here.
Yeah. So, which I guess also it nicely limits it, because there's 12.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but did you still get people who are like, so, what are you doing in October? Because, you know, we wrote this song. You know what I mean? Does that make it weird, too? Yeah. When you say, oh, there's 12, I picked them. Well, I'm sorry, we're good. Maybe there'll be a bus crash. But, you know, if there's a bus crash, we'll call you. But don't talk to me.
It was tough. It was tough because I conceived of the project and I contacted the bands. And I did it quietly and I just said, you know, because the other thing is that I wasn't really sure from the get-go, like, when I came up with the idea at the end of 2012.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a big calendar person. I meticulously look at calendars and sort of plan stuff. And, you know, I was looking at it and realizing this is how it'd have to work, and this would be the timing that you'd need to do it. And, you know, then talking to the pressing plant, I use Gotta Groove Records in Cleveland. I can't say enough great things about them. And talked to them and said, like, I'm going to have this crazy release schedule. Are you really, like, up for this? This is, like, and they were totally cool and have worked with me on all of these to, you know, to make sure that they get done. And so I talked to the bands, and then I set it up in a way so that, knowing there were going to be problems, that there would be, like, contingencies, you know, one band broke up, and, you know, so I sort of, there were some people I talked to and said, like, I can't promise this is going to happen, but, you know, I'm telling you, you're basically second string here, not for any other reason but the limitations. But people would say, you know, I still get emails of people saying, like, are you taking demos? Are you auditioning bands? Or are you, and, you know, it is easier to just sort of be able to explain the entire thing to them. And then also to say, you know, I listen to the stuff. People send me stuff, I'll listen to it, if for no other reason than to give them feedback, or just to say, you know, I spread the knowledge of making records as much as I can. You know, if you can scrape together $800 or $900, like, you can make a record. It's you can do it. But I still, and then there, of course, there's people who, you know, I've known my my entire adult life who are bummed I didn't pick their band.
Oh,
and yeah. But then I'd explain to them. I'd be like, well, you're always saying, like, we haven't practiced in a month, and this is, like, never working. And then they're like, why didn't you ask me to do a record? And I'm like, you just told me, basically, that you're a non-functioning band. So, you know, it gets yes. tricky. But so far, there haven't been too many hurt feelings.
That's good. And you're also making a documentary, right? Yes.
That really, like, got legs of its own around this grant that came up that was from a local organization called the Sprout Fund, and they were doing a grant specifically for film and video projects. And I had been in doing all the stuff about Pittsburgh with the singles that I put out. I make a video about each band to sort of, like, I don't know, like, let the band say who they are, or, you know, to sort of show that there is this, like, you know, variety of sub sort of scenes within the city. And also, I just think it's a medium, like, I think more people watch those videos than could actually buy the records. Yeah. I mean, like, some of those videos have been watched over 1,000 times, and there's only 300 records. So,
yeah,
like, and some of them are funny, and some of them, I think video is a great medium for spreading information now that everyone's walking around with, you know, like a Star Trek level device in their pocket. But on the reissues, I started shooting interviews with bands because, you know, a lot of these bands never played outside of Pittsburgh, or maybe they only existed for 8 months, and just started shooting footage and interviews of people talking about Pittsburgh in the 80s, talking about skateboarding, talking about graffiti, talking about whatever. And so then I found out about this grant, and someone said, the guy who helps me with all the videos for the, when I say helps me is an understatement, the guy who makes possible all these videos of the month, someone had approached him and said, you should apply for this grant because I see all these videos you're making about Pittsburgh bands, and this would be perfect for this grant. And being a good friend, he said, well, those actually aren't my projects. Those are my friend's projects that I work with him on. Yeah. And he told me about it. And he said, I think you should, you know, scrape together the footage you've been shooting about Pittsburgh punk in the 80s, which I'd talked about doing a documentary, but it wasn't a fully formed idea.
Yeah.
And so I edited together this trailer and entered it into this grant, and I got it. But I think that for some people, they thought that it was, like, complete. Like, that's another thing. People will be like, I don't know why you didn't, you know, interview me. And I'll be like, this is nowhere near done.
Done.
I will absolutely get in touch with you. Mm-hmm. And then I explain it. But, you know, in full disclosure, my father is a documentary filmmaker. Mm-hmm. He helped me with that trailer and helped me get all of this together. And it looks super pro and super slick.
Yes. Yes, it does.
And it helps when, you know, you have a, you know, 40-year veteran of documentary filmmaking who is, you know, 3 miles and one phone call away.
That's awesome, yeah.
So, me and my dad are very close. I'm very close to both my parents. I don't care if that's not cool. I love my parents.
That's good. Now, my uncle, he went to Duquesne from, 78 to 82. I showed him the trailer. He's very excited. He's waiting, anticipating.
Well, the goal is, so the anniversary of the stores, June 28th, and is to have some, like, you know, segment of it done around that anniversary. And to, I mean, I think that it'll realistically be done in about a year, but to try to get these larger segments together that can be put online, in working with the Sprout Fund and Pittsburgh filmmakers with this grant, there's a talk of some sort of showing of maybe a cut or like an incomplete version of the films that they gave grants to. So there's going to be lots to see coming up.
Awesome. Awesome. So on that note,
okay,
it's now time for the bottom five.
All right.
Bottom five is a series of questions not related to our main topic, though they usually sometimes are, and are of a surrealistic and or philosophical nature. Are you ready, Mike?
Lay it on me.
All right. Question one. If reincarnation is real and you had to come back as an infectious disease or illness, what kind of disease would you be?
Ooh, that's a good one.
You had to go single cell, like you really fucked up, like in this life, like God really likes instead, or the higher power, whatever was really, you know, in the iTunes. And so, you know, against vinyl. Vinyl makes Baby Jesus Cry or Buddha or whatever cry. And you had to, like, start over a single cell that kind of messed with people.
I think that if I was going to be, you know, some sort of disease, it's tough because, like, this sounds really stupid. Being something that would, like, cause people, you know, pain with, like, I don't know, that'd be tough for me. I really don't like hurting people. What would be...
Well, there's that digestive gut bacteria that people, like, need.
Oh, yeah, that's good. I take that. So that I would, yeah. But you just
think that one. Gut bacteria.
I would be probiotics or whatever it is. Yeah.
There we go.
Kimchi, right. Probiotics.
Yeah. There you go. Activia. Anyway, if you had to choose, would you welcome the total elimination of day or night?
I would welcome the total elimination of night, actually, because I really like natural daylight.
Mm.
And as much as I love being a nocturnal creature, I would lose it without daylight.
Yeah, you're a vitamin D fiend, is what you're saying.
That's right.
All right. Question 3. What is your most irrational pet peeve?
People clicking their fingernails. The sound of people...
Oh, yeah, that is pretty terrible.
And it will send me into a... I don't want to say blind rage, but it'll make me really agitated. My mom will occasionally forget. She knows how much it bothers me, will occasionally forget. And then we get to replay, you know, sort of like me as an adolescent all over again. She can remind me of how ridiculous it is that has as profound an effect on me as it does.
I get you. The fingernails thing gets me too. I used to have a math tutor because I was always really bad with math.
Mm.
And so Algebra 1 in high school, freshman year, just wasn't happening. It just wasn't. And so my mom knew this lady. I think it was my mom's Mary Kay dealer.
Okay.
And she had these super long fingernails. And so I would sit at her kitchen table and I would work, try to figure out math. And she would do this thing where she'd like, click her, or like the fingernails would snap against the table, and I still have nightmares about it, and I totally blame her for my inability to calculate a 20% tip when I go to a restaurant.
I think a sub answer to that would be people who always talk about how busy they are. That drives me crazy. Because, I mean, like, everyone's busy. You're, like, you're a parent. You're really busy. I don't, like, it's just... Yeah. But I think it's, like, a thing that people... It's, like, it sort of tries to elevate their importance.
Yeah.
You know? So that's, like... But clicking fingernails, number one. Talking about how busy you are, number two.
There we go. All right. Question 4. So maybe this could lead... This could be a good segue or not. Of the living villains of history. Of the living villains of history. This person has to still be alive. Whose obituary would you like to write? You could.
The living villains of history, whose obituary would I most like to write?
Yes, this is the Christopher Hitchens question
in
his book Mortality. When he found out, like, oh, you're going to die, one of the things he said is he said, you know, he wished he could have written Henry Kissinger's and Cardinal Ratzinger's obituaries. And that was like the biggest, like, oh, I'm not going to get to do that.
Yeah.
He should have put it in the can, though.
Yeah, yeah. I mean... There's a lot of good candidates. I mean, you know, on a serious note, you know, like Dick Cheney, that would be like a really good one. I think that, you know, I mean, there's any number of politicians, sure. But I'm trying to come up with something funny, and I'm like really not, I'm not doing it. Tom Hanks?
Oh, really? Tom Hanks?
Yeah.
As a living villain of history.
Yeah, I think Tom Hanks is I mean, his behavior is villainous to me. I think that he so, sure, we'll say Tom Hanks.
Sweet. All right. All right, final one. You're almost out of the woods.
Okay,
so we talked about, okay, you are a businessman, you got the record store, you have an ear for music, you have a label, you're making a movie, but... Is there an artistic skill or talent that you wish you possessed? Renaissance man that you are. Is there something still like, damn it, I just can't do that?
I've always wished that I could draw.
Mm.
And I've tried drawing. I don't have it. I don't know what it is. I wish I could, because it seems like it'd be so pleasurable. Like you would always be your own best friend, that all you needed was a pen and a piece of paper, and you could sit down and be like, look at this crazy thing that I did.
Yeah.
That would be it.
All right. So I think that's about it. Now, I'll have a link on the website to the store and the address, but if you want to tell the folks contact the Mind Cure Media Empire or get in touch. Or
you can come and visit me in person at Mind Cure Records, which is 3138 Dobson Street, Pittsburgh, PA, 15219, in scenic Polish Hill.
That's on the 54C as well.
The 54C stop right out front, depending on which way you're coming from, or around the corner. You can visit us on the internet at www.mindcurerecords.com. Or you can email me at orders@mindcurerecords.com. We also have Facebook, Instagram, a very neglected Tumblr site because I don't know how Tumblr works. It seems that it's just a lot of pornography and cat pictures.
That's a new frontier for Mind Cure.
Then, yeah, you know? I think that's... I'm going to get into... I think that... I mean,
once the single thing's over...
Ultimately... pornography and prostitution are going to be the only jobs left for humans, so that's just where everyone is headed, because, you know, until they come up with sex robots,
it's, see, I think it. Sex bots are coming. I think we'll have sex bots sooner than you think.
You're probably right, but, you know, until then, we're just going to get more and more disposable unless you're a hooker. So, that's it.
That's it. All right, so our next episode will eventually happen, and it will be about something. Our homepage, where you can find new and old episodes, is gonnadiepodcast.com. We're also on... Yes, we're on iTunes. But you can download from the website, not from iTunes. Follow us on Twitter at gonnadiepodcast. And We're All Gonna Die is on Facebook and Google Plus. Now, is there a Mind Cure Google Plus?
There's not.
Ooh, yeah. I actually just got my first Google Plus follower that's not me.
Really?
Yes. Wow. It's amazing. And thanks to Brett Zork, as always, for the lovely theme music. Later, meets.